for the purification of mind, for overcoming sorrow and distress, for the end of pain and sadness, and for realizing the liberation of mind, one should abide ardent, clearly aware, and mindful, the Buddha said. These words of the Buddha are taken from the Satipatthana discourse, or the Satipatthana Sutra, the sutta, or the discourse on mindfulness. And in it, the Buddha gives us his assurance, or maybe a guarantee, that if one was to abide, to live, ardent, meaning full of energy, and clearly aware and mindful, that one would, in time, free one's mind from all of the sources of suffering, suffering and the sources of suffering. Do you believe that?
Yeah.
Okay. If we believe that abiding ardent, clearly aware, and mindful could really disentangle the mind from all of its suffering and the causes of suffering, what else would we want to do? Well, given the human limitations of time and energy and our current state of aspiration, commitment, confidence, knowledge, wisdom, we find plenty of other things to do. But since we're here and we do have another week to go, and well, we might as well make the effort, because really there's not much else to do here. You may have noticed that the joy of an unscheduled day soon looms as a boring afternoon. So since we have the time, we're here, and there's nothing else to do, what is mindfulness? You know, and all of you have been trying to develop mindful awareness and the momentum of mindful awareness for days, weeks, years, decades, some of us. And while we do get some sense of what mindful awareness is, it still remains pretty elusive to develop on an ongoing basis and to understand when it arises, when it doesn't arise, and what the conditions are for its arising and its non-arising. It's important to look at our understanding of the mind, our understanding or our misunderstanding of the mind and our understanding of the mind, how we understand practice, how we understand what mindfulness is, because how we understand practice, mindfulness in the role of practice, will make a huge difference in terms of how we apply ourselves, the level of confidence that we practice with, the level of energy we're willing to commit to practice, the skill with which we practice. And so it bears some study, some knowledge, some acquiring of information, and some careful thought, really, as to what it is that we're trying to do here. To just come and sit and walk and sit and walk and just willy-nilly just kind of hope it all happens. I remember going to Pandita first time I was practicing with him, and he could see that I wasn't doing too good. And so he asked me, well, embarrassingly, he asked me who my teachers were. Of course, they were all senior teachers who were all practicing at that very retreat with me. And I can't imagine what he thought. But I told him that I thought, you just sit and walk and do your best, and one day, poof, you're enlightened. And when I told him that, he just roared with laughter. You know, I guess just at my naivety or my lack of clear understanding. It wasn't a hurtful laugh. It was just a, you know, probably a laugh of compassion. Just like, wow, okay, You know, and interestingly, at the end of that, Upandita had been invited to come to America the first time in 84 to lead a three-month retreat for 20 students who were all teachers or who were on the track to become teachers. However, I was not one of them. I was the director of the meditation center where it was going to be held, and I insisted on being able to attend the retreat, so I got my wish. Sayadaw was told that everybody that was doing the retreat was teacher or on the track. But he was courageous. At the end of the three-month retreat, in my last interview, he told me, he says, you know, you should not teach. He says it would be better to practice some more, and of course you can share your experience with others, but you should not teach. Of course, that was not a shameful, or that was no surprise to me. It was the furthest thing from my mind. I like to tease him a little bit, because several years later, after having practiced with him for several years, he encouraged me to teach. So it's a confirmation that where you find yourself now in the development of mindfulness is no indication of your potential and what can be accomplished with right understanding, right effort, right mindfulness. And it really is a process of developing momentum and slowly acquiring understanding of the way things are, and then learning to live in harmony with it. And well, if I can be here, anybody can be here, because it was hard. I mean, it was hard for me, and I know second, third day of a retreat like this for many of you is, you know, we call it the maximum dukkha day, when, you know, the body's still a little achy and restless, and the mind is sleepy and dull, and, you know, we've still got some hopes hanging on to them with dear life, hoping that something, some good comes out of our efforts on the retreat, but it will. It just takes some patient perseverance. So what is this mindfulness that we're working so hard and so diligently to cultivate? Do we even recognize it when we're mindful? Because mindfulness is awareness. But aren't we aware all the time of something? And what's the difference between, you know, being generally aware and being mindfully, meditatively aware, if there is any? You know, if you walk up to someone walking down the street of Castle Rock and you said, hey, are you aware that you're walking down the street? They'd look at you like you were a nut. Are you aware? Of course I'm aware I'm walking down the street. But do you really think they're mindfully aware of walking down the street? No. Because you know how hard it is to walk mindfully aware from here to the dining room. And so what makes us so sure that we're aware and so unconfident that we're mindful? What's the difference? It's a peculiar state of mind, isn't it? To just to be able to participate in the moment of your life while simultaneously recognizing it, knowing it, being aware of it. If you're not fully present and participating in it, you may have a very detached, kind of aloof, objective view of what's going on, but you won't be in touch with it. On the other hand, if you're just subjectively indulging in just kind of being in the moment, you may have no awareness or no objectivity of what's going on. So mindful awareness is really in the midpoint between subjective indulgence and objective what? Detachment. Where we're in touch and yet still able to step back and be aware of both what is occurring in the present moment and awareness of that which is occurring. Sometimes we call it bare attention. I'll speak more about that, because bare attention means attention bare of any other agenda, free of any other encumbrance, if you will. It's just pure attention. It has the characteristic of not floating away, or the texts say, not floating away. And what that means is that awareness or mindfulness has the capacity to touch the present moment. Not just to superficially glance off the present moment, but to actually touch it very intimately. To really feel the present moment intimately. And when we do that, or when the mind is capable of this touching and recognizing, then the flavor of the present moment's experience is known. And so much of our ordinary life is full of busyness and distraction and activity and the pursuit of stimulation, with very little recognition of what the taste of all that experience really is. You may have already noticed that just by paying attention, even the simplest activities here start to feel much more alive and intense and flavorful, if you will. There's just more to a sip of tea, a bite of apple, you know, a painful knee, or whatever. Or when you walk outside in the morning after the first sitting, and you just kind of immerse yourself, you find yourself immersed in the forest, and you just kind of tune into the space of the forest. We walk through the forest every day. I mean, or some of us do. And never notice it. Until there's more mindfulness, more continuity of awareness, and then being in the forest is really being in the forest. And there's just a much greater sensory impact, a much greater perception of the flavor of what that experience really is. That's mindfulness. Saito Pandita says, life without mindfulness is like food without salt. Salt, while it has its own flavor, brings out the flavor of anything else that it's put on. Yeah, you can taste a piece of, you know, boiled squash. But if you put a little salt on it, it's got quite a different flavor. The same with a life of mindfulness has a lot more flavor than just a life of distraction and busyness. The function of mindfulness, as Saito Tejaniya mentioned yesterday, is to remember. And so the question could arise in our mind to remember what? I'm sure you have plenty of memories which have nothing to do with mindfulness. And not being able to remember also doesn't have much to do with mindfulness. But rather, it's the remembering of this present moment. To be able to remember yourself in this present moment. To remember this present moment. To be present for this present moment. Again, that first year I was... In 84, when I was practicing with Upandita, I was having a very difficult time, and of course everybody else was doing really well. I knew. They were all teachers. And I was following this one woman who was on the track to teach and hadn't been yet teaching, but she had pretty good mindfulness. And in that situation where we were being interviewed every day, down at the end of the hall, Upandita's doors would be open, she'd go in, she'd give her report, and I'd hear a little bit of their interchange, and as soon as she came out, I'd go in. Well, one day I was standing in the hall waiting for her to do her report, and she was so excited. She was telling Sayadaw about remembering her past lives and what she was doing, and you know, in those lives and conditions and things like that. She was just so excited, and I was sitting there thinking, okay, let me wrap my head around that one. So I, you know, of course, naturally my comparing mind kicked in, and you know, I inflated her and deflated myself. I walked in feeling pretty, and so in my utter kind of like bad feeling about myself and frustration with my practice, I just blurted out to Upandita. I said, "What are we doing here? Are we supposed to be remembering our past lives or something?" And he just calmly looked at me and said, "No. This life. Remembering to be present for this life." I almost got it. You know, it's... if someone were to just kind of sit on your shoulder, if you had a little mindfulness reminder, a little elf sitting on your shoulder, just pointing out all that you could and should be mindful of in this moment. Notice that, look at this, hear that, feel this, feel that. It would be easy. Of course, it might drive you to distraction, but when reminded, we can be mindful. We can tune in. We can recognize what we're experiencing at the time it's happening. So it's not difficult to be mindful. It's difficult to remember to be mindful. And that's the whole function of mindfulness, is to remember. To remember that, to remember this moment, to remember to be present for this moment. So mindfulness has this function of remembering, and when it does, it is able to face the moment, to come face to face with, this is what's happening. It's not that this is what's happening kind of out there. It's what is happening or what is arising in the mind at that time. Because, you know, there's a lot going on all the time. There's stuff going on outside of ourselves. There's things to see, things to hear, things to feel, all kinds of thoughts to have. But in any one moment, there's just kind of one thing kind of emerges from the background. And that's the present moment's experience. That's what we need to remember. We don't need to try to catch up with everything that's going on out there. We don't need to try to hurriedly catch everything, notice everything. We'll just burn out quickly. But rather to just let the present moment arise or emerge and recognize it, remembering to recognize it. There's two proximate causes for the arising of mindfulness. And this is important because they both involve understanding and possibly technique for you in your practice, in cultivating your practice. And the first of them is... a prior moment of mindfulness. If this moment, if you're mindful this moment, you're more likely to be mindful the next moment. Now, what does that tell us? It tells us that the development of mindfulness is gradual, and there does develop a certain momentum. Because if there's only one instance of mindfulness in a minute, there's going to be a lot of unmindful moments the next minute. But for each moment that you're mindful, it predisposes the mind to be mindful for the next moment. And so the more the mind is predisposed to be mindful, the more mindful it will become gradually. And so it tells us that the development of mindfulness and development of momentum will occur gradually. We don't have to doubt that. We don't have to push it. We don't have to insist on it. We just have to do what we can to recognize this moment. The second proximate cause of a moment of mindfulness is clear perception. I'm going to speak more about perception, but let me just say that for now that perception is recognition, recognizing. So that when we recognize this moment clearly, correctly, we know it as it truly is, the clarity of that recognition strengthens or supports mindfulness in the next moment. How can we, if that's true, if clear perception strengthens continuity of mindfulness, how can we strengthen our perception? Well, if perception is recognizing, if we know that we're recognizing this moment, it will strengthen, that's clear perception, it will strengthen the next moment of mindfulness. Well, the grossest form of recognition is to name your experience, to name it. And some of you have, any of you who practice with me have been taught labeling. Labeling is a technique, but it's a technique that is built on a natural activity of the mind, perception, that recognizes and names experience, distinguishes one from the other, and names it. When we use a label to name what we have recognized in this moment, it is a strong activity of mind, or it's a strong function of mind, and it has the power to condition the next moment to also be clearly perceived and mindful. So labeling is a tool. It's a tool for strengthening perception. However, as you know, labeling can sometimes be quite loud, noisy, and cumbersome in the mind. Especially when the perception is kind of up and running, your mindfulness has some momentum, there's some continuity, to kind of keep intending to strengthen your perception with labeling actually can get in the way of clearly perceiving. And so it's a tool. And like any tool, it's good for a specific purpose, but not useful for everything, for every job that needs to be done. So, when do we use labeling? Well, we use labeling when we're not clearly recognizing our experience, when there's new experience, when the experience is overwhelming, when the experience is, I was going to say chaotic, but let me just say, not chaotic, but when there's a lot of pieces to it, the present moment, if you can name that. Then you can begin to steady your perception of what's going on. If it's diffuse, if it's new, if it's overwhelming, if it's multi-something. Anyway, multi.
Huh?
Multifarious. That sounds nefarious. Is that nefarious? Anyway, it's a tool to be used in those times. But when the perception is, when there's some momentum to the mindfulness, and there's a clarity of what's going on, to continue to label is counterindicated. So, be willing to let it go. Drop it. Nevertheless, you may notice that the mind often, without there being a strong intention to label your experience, still is kind of narrating what's going on. Your mind is just kind of like, okay, yeah, knowing this, recognize, oh yeah, this, yeah, okay, And so sometimes noting becomes narrating, which is okay in the beginning because it does kind of keep a stream of recognition going on while the momentum of your mindfulness is building. But later, when there's some momentum in the mind, narrating is just useless chatter getting in the way of clear perception. So I'm talking about these tools and techniques because they're useful at different times in practice. And at other times in practice, they need to be let go of. And the reason I'm talking about it in this way is that sometimes we get, well, attached to our techniques. And we just keep using them. They might have been good at one time, and we keep using them and insisting on them when long past their use-by date. So, use them when you need them. Let them go when you don't. I went online today to check my mail and read the news. The news, the most emailed news report today on Yahoo was about taming your emotions. Taming your emotions. Now, do you know what the scientists have now discovered helps you to tame your emotions? Naming them. If you name your emotions, you can tame them. Brain scans show that putting negative emotions into words calms the brain's emotional center. Meditators label their negative emotions to help let go of them. When you put feeling into words, you seem to be hitting the brake on emotional reactivity. Meditators' brain scans were starkly different than non-meditators, in that there was a greater activity in the area associated with thinking in words about emotional experience and a decrease in the activity of emotional processing. Well, that's been obvious to some of us for a long time. But science is just catching up. But anyway, sometimes people might hear that and have more respect for just the value of noting and the usefulness of naming your experience. Time goes by. So that's all I want to say about mindfulness or right mindfulness. The second thing I want to speak about is right attitude. This morning someone asked about attitude towards pain and how to recognize our attitudes. It's, you know, when we first hear about right attitude, wrong attitudes, it's a little hard to kind of get a grip on it, to really understand or to know, well, what's an attitude, and is this a right one, is this a good one, is this a bad one? One way of understanding attitudes is they appear as agendas to your mindfulness. So you may find that you're practicing awareness, or you're practicing your mindfulness, but that you have this agenda to kind of create a meditative experience, however you imagine that to be, you know, calm, clear, upright. And so there's this hidden agenda to not only be paying attention to the present moment, but with this agenda to kind of look for a certain kind of experience. Or we may have an agenda to avoid certain kinds of experience. And even though we know that, well, sometimes that's what's arising, when pain arises in the body or discomfort, or thinking arises in the mind, there can slip in this unannounced agenda to get rid of it, to avoid it, to dismiss it, to ignore it. That's wrong attitude. To think that, oh, I don't need to pay attention to this. I don't need to observe this. I can, you know, it's more important to be observing the breath. If you have the idea that it's more important or better practice to be observing one thing than another, wrong attitude, wrong understanding. No experience is hierarchically better to be observing. If it's arising in the present moment, that's the object to be observed. It can be a thought, it can be a defilement, it can be a sensation, it can be pleasant, it can be unpleasant, it can be internal, it can be external, it can be familiar, it can be novel, it can be gross, it can be subtle. It really doesn't matter at all what the experience is that's arising and being known. If we have a hierarchy of preference, wrong attitude, sure to cause you suffering. So how can we use that understanding and a primary object at the same time? Well, a primary object or an initial object is an object that you choose to pay attention to, like the breath, at the nostrils, at the belly, wherever. And it's an object that you choose, that you have an intention to connect with some regularity, not because it is the only object, or the best object, or the meditator's object, but because it's a single object that you can remember easily to kind of check with a little more frequency. And in that greater continuity of attending to a single object, the continuity or the momentum of your mindfulness grows and becomes more strong. But while doing that, when your attention is called to other sensations, thoughts, sounds in the rooms, or whatever, if they're not recognized, perceived, then there's striving in the mind. There's that striving that wants to get back to the breath. That wrong attitude. So, if you're using a primary object, or if you're using a chosen initial object to develop the stability of your mind, we have to also be willing to acknowledge what else is being known when the mind goes elsewhere. Or there will be this judgment of it. You know, the mind slips off the breath and it goes to a sound, or it goes to a thought, or it goes to a sensation in the body, and there's this, you know, kind of criticism or condemnation of the mind doing that. The mind is active. You've noticed the mind is alive. It's just dynamic. It's agile. It goes wherever it wants to go. The challenge for awareness is to know where it goes. We can direct it, but it will also go where it will. So in the directing, we can develop, or we can begin to encourage a stability of awareness. But in the going where it will, the mindfulness needs to be a little more agile to be able to recognize where it goes. Trying to create a meditative experience, trying to get rid of an unpleasant experience. Sometimes we're observing the present moment in order to figure it out. In order to figure it out for ourselves. Why am I having this experience? Huh. I wonder why I'm having this experience and not that experience. And so the mind is kind of maybe observing the present moment, but it's got this agenda in the background running, trying to figure it out. Wrong attitude. That's not bare attention. That's attention with an agenda. Sometimes we are analyzing and comparing or evaluating our experience, trying to determine, is this a better meditation than the last sitting? Because in the last sitting, it was clear and calm and pleasant, and this time it's harsh and rough and unpleasant. Which is better? There's no better. If observing is happening, observing pleasant is not better than observing unpleasant. Observing subtle is not better than observing gross. Observing familiar is not better than observing novel. It's our attitude in the mind that prefers pleasant to unpleasant, subtle to gross. Wrong attitude. Because when those grosser, unpleasant, or boring, if you will, objects arise, we'll feel, and we're caught. Then we have a judgment of our practice, we have a wrong attitude, we suffer. These wrong attitudes are subtle. They don't announce themselves really loud and clear. You have to just kind of watch out of the corner of your eyes with some sensitivity as to just what's the agenda behind the looking. Here's the object, but what's the energy of the observing? Is there some insistence? Is there some resentment? Is there some avoidance? Is there some laziness to it? What's the energy of the observing? Sometimes we want to explain how something is happening. So we look at it, we're observing it, so that we can explain, as if we're going to explain to someone else, how it happens. Well, it's good to be observing that close, but with the agenda to explain it to someone, we're not seeing things clearly. Often, 100% of the time, initially, we personalize the experience so that what we're observing feels like it's me, it's mine, it's my pain. It's really hard to feel pain in the body and not think as my pain. It's almost impossible. But we often don't notice it. We don't notice it because that's what we've always done our whole life, is personalize what happens to this body. We don't see it as just the impersonal arising of conditions that are unpleasant. And so there's a wrong understanding in the observing of pain. And there's often a little bit of aversion wanting to get rid of it. Wrong attitude. So I mention all these just so you can begin to recognize them in your own experience. I remember when I was practicing in Burma, I can remember where I was walking. I was walking on the backside of a little hallway in the foreign men's dorm at the meditation center I was in. And I was walking in that direction towards the bathroom. And it came to me that my default agenda was self-pity. Whenever I became aware of an unpleasantness or a difficulty or doubt in the mind, it appeared in my mind as, oh, poor me. And just in that, oh, poor me, was Well, you can just say, oh, poor me, and the whole body just collapses. But it's really the mind just collapsing into a feeling of ineffectualness, incapacity, inability to do the practice. I didn't see it for more than 10 years. It was there all the time in my practice. Never saw it for more than 10 years. But once I saw it, I made a point that I would never, because I saw how debilitating it was. You know, when you get caught in the oh poor me, it's a struggle to get out of it. But once you see it, then you recognize it. Then it's, you know, I had high alert, red alert for any flicker of self-pity that would kind of pull the plug on practice. It's an attachment to our mindfulness, if you will. And I mention it because, I mention the whole 10-year thing because we're all practicing with hidden agendas. We're all practicing with, well, dozens of wrong understandings, wrong attitudes, that only through just clearly recognizing moment after moment after moment after moment will we begin to identify them, recognize them, and really see them functioning in our life. There's no shame in that. And, you know, there's no shame in saying, hey, I was caught in self-pity for 10 years. You know, you'll be able to say the same thing. If not self-pity, it'll be something else. Because that's the nature of the deluded mind. It doesn't see what's happening. Or it sees and understands wrongly. But in that seeing and understanding wrongly, we think we're seeing rightly. That's really dangerous. You know, you look at something and you think, I know this is the way it is. I see it. And it's wrong. You have to ask yourself, how can I stop that from happening? How can I prevent that from happening? You can't. You can't prevent that from happening. You can only develop mindfulness and see it happening. Then when you see it happening, it'll stop. There's another wrong view, if you will, or a wrong understanding of practice, that a wrong understanding of reality that attaches itself to our mindfulness. And I call it eternalizing. This is this is how I perceived it. You know, you're with some experience, and it may be difficult or it may be pleasant, it doesn't really matter. But the feeling, this is the way it's going to be forever, creeps in. I mean, logically we know, well, that's ridiculous. But it's the feeling, this is the way it's going to be forever. I'm never going to be free of my impatience. I'm always going to be impatient. Or this pain is always going to be like this. I'm never going to be able to be free of pain. I'm never going to be able to get my mindfulness together. Or when experience is nice and you have a sitting that's kind of calm and clear, you know, and just kind of like effortless, you think, ha, now I got it, this is the way it's going to be forever, or at least for the rest of the retreat. It isn't. But that wrong understanding comes with all experience until we have seen clearly time and time and time again and really understand. Everything's impermanent. Everything's impermanent. These wrong understandings, these wrong attitudes, wrong views, we're blind to them. That's why we practice, in order to discover them or uncover them. There are many more that I could mention, but I think that's probably enough for now. Because right attitude really is awareness without all those. So what does that mean? It means just being as open, as receptive, as acknowledging, and as tolerant as you can be for whatever happens. No preference. Difficult, isn't it? Really difficult to do that. And yet, in any moment that we remember to just relax the body, relax the mind, notice what's happening, then that's a moment of as clear awareness and as unencumbered a mindfulness as possible. But it's so easy to forget. Just, you know, a couple of moments of that, and then we just start leaning into our experience in some way. Or kind of withdrawing from our experience in some way. You can see it in your body posture. You want to know what attitude you got in your mind? Check your body posture. Especially the facial expression. You know, you're kind of squinting and looking, or, you know, kind of holding yourself back or leaning forward or hunched shoulders. I mean, it's written all over us what attitudes we have in the mind as we approach this moment. Yeah. I wanted to mention a little bit about, I mentioned right mindfulness, right thought, right attitude. Do I go into this? No. It's another whole section that is really interesting to get, but I want to speak about one piece of the practice or one piece of the path that emerges with mindfulness. And that is, you know, I've been talking about all of the hidden agendas we have, all the wrong attitudes that we have, all the wrong understandings, the delusions that we live with. Saito Pandita talks about multiple layers of delusion. You know, the first one being not aware of the present moment. Then once you're aware of the present moment, you may be aware of it, but understand it wrongly. And how you understand the present moment, even when you're aware of it, has multiple layers of refined understanding. So just getting in touch with the present moment is the first, is cutting through the first layer of delusion, if you will, of confusion, of not being present. And one of the tasks that seems to occur in most of us is coming to grips with our personal history. We all live with this incessant narrator in our head who takes every experience of this mind-body stream and weaves it into the tapestry of my life. And now I could ask any one of you, who are you? And the narrator would have a field day. I just kind of like yada 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 with whatever selected and heavily edited behaviors and experiences you choose to present to the world. Well, the view of ourself that we have of ourself is heavily edited. The view of ourself that we present to others is even more so. In this practice of awareness and mindfulness and remembering and recollecting and recalling, we are going to turn that spotlight of awareness on that personal history, because so much of what we come in contact with is the story in our head, who I am. And it's going to come into view. And so there's going to be this, well, personal history review, as most of you know, where memories of personal events will come up for review and kind of testing us. You know, can you be mindful of this now, finally? And sometimes we can and sometimes we can't. Because what comes with this clear, powerful awareness is an unadulterated view of that memory, where you see it now as it truly was. without any defenses, without any protection. You just see it. That's the way it was. And so the intensity of the feelings and the dropping away of the rationalizations and the defenses makes for a pretty intense experience. But it's necessary because we live in illusion. We live in delusion. And we live in illusion. A large part of practice is disillusioning. And when we feel disillusioned with something, it's usually pretty unpleasant. If you feel disillusioned with someone, disenchanted with someone, it's difficult. It's a significant shift in your relationship with that person, especially when it's yourself. But that's what's required, is to get a clear understanding of what this process is here, and to see the full mind of this process that has been hidden from our view when we didn't have so much awareness. And so this process of disillusionment, disenchantment with the internal narrator is a task that we all are engaged in. And that's what makes it so hard in one way, because this story of our life has been told to us from the time of our birth by our parents initially, by every authority, every teacher, every friend, and we've carried it on when they haven't been there to do it for us. And we've told ourselves this story hundreds of thousands of times. Now we're going to get to see it as it truly was. And it's often not the way we remember it. It's not the story we tell ourselves. And so what we find out about ourselves, this self-discovery is destabilizing, can be destabilizing, can be very challenging to open to. This is the way it was. One little mantra that helps is to remember that all of this experience is just impersonal events arising and passing away that we happen to get identified with. And so if you can remind yourself that all that has happened, not me, not mine, not who I am, it's me, mine, and who I am to the extent that we're deluded and attached. When we see through the delusion and we learn to let go, then we understand all of this is not me, not mine, not who I am. It's a magnificent journey of self-discovery. I don't remember who it was that said, but self-knowledge is no good news. Nevertheless, it is very freeing. So I want to end with a little reminder from Kalu Rinpoche. And this is paraphrased because I couldn't find the original. But we live in illusion in the appearance of things. There is a reality. We are that reality. And when you understand this, you see that you are everything. And being everything, you are nothing. That is all. So let's sit for a moment. Let the words quiet down. Sayadaw says, when your understanding of the true nature of things grows, your values in life will change. When your values change, your priorities change as well. And through such understanding, you will naturally practice more, and this will help you to do well in life.